hopefully a relatively easier day than we've had in our last sessions for the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Four House bills. We'll take them right in order. Good morning, Mary. And open a hearing on House Bill 2229.
You want me to introduce each one or one in order?
Yeah, let's take them, I guess,
whatever.
Are all four your bills?
So all four are my bills, and they're all Department of Revenue requested bills.
Okay. Well, let's do one at a time since we just have Senator George and myself here.
House Bill 2239, the intent of this measure is to reduce the interest that is paid on property tax refund to an amount equal to the portion of the refund that is not attributable to inaccurate reporting statements or written information provided by the taxpayer. As you know, during certain appeals, which can involve a lot of money, where the Department of Revenue has done some central assessment on utilities or commercial property or industrial property, If the taxpayer makes an error in some portion of the tax return and it goes to appeal, that entire amount is under appeal. Even if their refunds due with interest at 12%, even if a portion of that tax dispute is based on inaccurate information. And so the department is requesting that the amount of the refund not be based on the amount that is attributable to taxpayer error.
Say that last part again. The amount of the refund
and the interest due on that would not be attributable to inaccurate reporting. Now, some portion of the report may have been in dispute that is based on correct data provided by the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. But if the taxpayer provided inaccurate data, then why should the department have to pay interest in a refund on the inaccurate portion of it? And that was the basis for this request.
Okay. Sounds reasonable. John Phillips and Doug Hillpot. This is House Bill 2229. I'm showing off my good hearing there.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I have a handout for you this morning, but essentially what this bill does is it talks about when interest is paid on refunds. Refunds are issued to taxpayers from time to time for various reasons, and one of those reasons is it has to do with the reporting that's done on personal and real returns. Let's say you're a residential property. Well, the assessor asserts a value in a residential property situation. In a business situation where you're filing a personal or real property return, telling the assessor what your value is, the assessor depends on that return because you know what property you have. You're reporting it, so it's self-reported. And what this bill talks about is if there's a reporting error, because you reported wrong, you shouldn't get interest on the refund that you're entitled to. You're definitely entitled to a refund of interest paid on taxes that you didn't owe, but there shouldn't be interest paid on that for your mistake. That's what the bill is about. There's a lot of background to it, of course. It does apply to more than just centrally assessed properties. It applies to all properties. So the general rule for interest in the property tax system is found in the bill, Section 1, Lines 6 and 7. And it basically says, except as provided in the subsections below, interest may not be paid on any tax refunds made under the authority of the refund statute. And then it makes several specific exceptions to that. One of those exceptions is if the error is made by the assessor. So if it's an error by the assessor and you have to make a refund, the law says interest should be paid. Not a problem. There's other issues with stipulations. And nowhere in here will you see that interest is payable when a taxpayer makes a reporting error. So there's no provision in here for taxpayers to receive interest when there's a reporting error. And so you'd ask, well, why do we have the bill then? And that's because when a taxpayer appeals, for whatever reason, let's say they dispute a value on a component of the property, but during the appeal process it's discovered that there was some double reporting or multiple reporting of assets, like, let's say, for example, they accidentally reported 10 machines when they only have 2. That's corrected in the appeal also, and then that becomes part of the final order, and the law provides for interest to be paid on final orders. So it's kind of a, I want to say, a backdoor way of getting interest on a refund whenever an appeal is, whether there's an order as a result of an appeal. And in that whole process, it's discovered there was inaccurate reporting. So I hope that helps you understand kind of where we're going with this. And
John, can you give us just a real-life example? Obviously, not a real-life example, but a hypothetical real-life
example. Sure, Senator Deckard. It does happen from time to time where someone will report a machine, let's say, and then the next year they have retired that machine. They've gotten rid of it. It's taken offline. It's sold to another company. And they don't. Then when they file their return again, they don't remove that piece of equipment. So it's kind of an inadvertence. And we're not saying any of these are intentional, but what can happen is something is either double reported or it's not been retired or removed from the return from the previous year. So then it looks like there's more there than what actually is. So those are the examples. On the back page of the testimony I gave you, your second page, and you're absolutely right, because of confidentiality requirements, we can't tell you about specific instances, although we have a pocket full of them. The second to the bottom paragraph talks about a specific example that happened in the past 5 years where someone overreported, failed to remove retirements, and then the appeal went forward, and the value of the over-reporting component, the interest on that, was $90,000. So to counties, our counties are concerned about limiting their exposure to interest that will then be shorted in distributions to local governments like schools and special districts and counties and cities. And the $90,000 is interest, essentially, on property that was over-reported in that case. We don't find it happening. I want to say we do find it happening a lot. Most of these are resolved between the appraiser and the taxpayer, and there's never any interest because there's never an appeal. So this happens very commonly. It's almost impossible to get a return perfectly correct, and so we deal with this all the time. The part that becomes the problem is where there's an appeal, and then it's involved in the appeal, and because there's an order, then all of a sudden there's interest. So that's where, and usually those are higher value accounts, and then there's more interest. So,
great. Questions? Mr. Hillpot.
Hi. For the record, I'm Doug Hillpot, Benton County Assessor, but I'm here for the County Assessors Association. And, yes, this happens even at the local level. We will have commercial properties that will be reporting, and due to whatever error, they will forget to list the retirements. They'll have machines that they haven't used or have been gone for years, and maybe they'll get a new accountant, and they go back and they do an inventory, and here there's up to maybe 20% of what was reported that shouldn't have been reported, and sometimes it's over several years. So they do have the ability to appeal that to magistrate, and just like John said, once it gets there and it's part of an order, then we pay interest, and it does not seem fair that the county should have to pay 12% interest on something that was reported, and in good faith we were taking the numbers from the company itself. So it's just really a fairness issue.
Okay. Okay. Can you hold on? Questions for? Okay, John Marshall, and we'll have them, and if you guys could hold on, I think they're going to give us opposition testimony. Yeah, if you could, wherever in this room or in this built capital, you must sit right there.
I get rebuttaled.
And David Canary.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And we're here this morning to express some concerns with House Bill 2229. I began my career around here about 30 years ago working with Oregon Tax Research, and at that time I had a pretty good understanding of Oregon's property tax system. After Measure 5 passed, it took me a while, but I sort of figured it out again. And with Measure 47 and 50, I've totally lost track, not only because of the complexity of those measures, but also as one ages, one tends to forget things. So with me is David Canary, and he's an attorney with the firm of Garvey, Schubert, and Bear in Portland, and he specializes in property tax appeals. And he has the bona fides to be the resident expert, since he was the former assistant attorney general in the tax division. So he's going to share the concerns that we have, and hopefully he will be able to respond to any questions you might have.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Canary. I have practiced in the property tax area for about 25 years and specialized just in that area. We have some real concerns about House Bill 2229, and really they come down to one main issue. I mean, there's three reasons why that I've put forth in the testimony as to why I have some concerns about. One is that this statute's been around since 1971. It's only now that the counties and the Department of Revenue are seeking to change it. I suspect that obviously there's concern about the interest paid on tax refunds. We had a bill two sessions ago that would have reduced the interest from 12%, as you recall. I think Senator Walker introduced it down to about 5%. But that bill actually was opposed by the Association of Oregon Counties because interest on deficiencies or failure to pay taxes was 16%. And as we found out in testimony, the counties and the Department of Revenue collected somewhere between 5 and 10 times more in interest on the 16% than they paid out on 12%. But the real problem with this bill is it is very vague as to what taxpayer error is, and I'll give you some very real life examples that I've been involved with. And it can lead to a lot more litigation than what currently is involved. And I would propose an amendment, ask that the committee consider an amendment when I finish my testimony, or at the end of my testimony. What happens is that the taxpayer has the burden of appealing an overassessment. And typically I represent commercial taxpayers and industrial taxpayers as well as utility taxpayers. So they have to hire typically an attorney to go to court. Then they get a refund, or at least they get a decision that can lead to a refund. This bill would then leave it within the ultimate discretion of either the county or the Department of Revenue to decide whether or not to pay interest on that and to because of something was a reporting error. Now, if there's not a definition of what a taxpayer reporting error is. Now, we've heard Mr. Phillips testify that it's almost impossible to get a return correct. And I have here, and unfortunately I didn't make enough copies, but I have here an industrial property return. It's got four pages of 8-point font type of instructions on how to fill out a return. And then it's got a return, then the return has another four pages of schedules you have to fill out. And I've got four copies. I'm happy to provide that if you want to take a look at it. But I agree with Mr. Phillips. It's almost impossible to get a return correct. Then there's the question when it talks about a taxpayer made on a report, which means a return, a statement, or any other information provided by a taxpayer. The question is, and the contentious part of it, is what is a taxpayer? Whose fault was it? Let me give you a couple of examples. In one case that I represented a taxpayer, you're required to report construction work in progress. That's taxed. At the end of that construction period the next year, then you're required to report at new additions. In this particular case, the taxpayer reported in 1 year the construction work in progress. When it was completed, following the form, correctly reported the addition. So the taxpayer correctly reported everything. The Department of Revenue simply took the value from the previous year, which included the construction work in progress, and simply added the addition to it the second year. So, in fact, the construction work in progress was counted twice. We had to litigate over whose fault that was. That's one example. Another example is on the report return, the department requests all kinds of information. For instance, environmental contamination. Has environmental contamination been found on this account? Yes. And then it asked for your cleanup costs. Well, in one situation, I mean, so these are cleanup costs that are imposed by either the EPA or DEQ. You've got to, at one point in time, you may have an expert like CH2M Hill come in and make an estimate. Later on, that estimate may change. Well, you report on here what the estimate was. A year later, when you're assessed, that changes. Is that a reporting error? Is that misinformation? Is that bad information? Is that the best information that was available? We had to litigate that issue. Not litigate, but we had to argue over it. So these are real-life examples of the contentiousness that can come from having to deal with the Department of Revenue and the county when they make a unilateral decision as to what's an error or not. Then it's up to the taxpayer to appeal that and make a determination. Now, where this is going to hit hardest is not the clients that can afford me to go into court and fight for them. It's going to hit the people that, where there's maybe, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 that they're entitled to, where the county has had their money for 1 or 2 years. And by the way, these cases can go on for 4 or 5 years. So yes, there is a substantial amount of interest that can accumulate. But in the smaller cases, there may not be very much. Rather than having one once in the tax court, you got to turn around and file another appeal in the tax court to get your interest. For smaller taxpayers, they're simply going to walk away from it. That's going to hurt them the most. Now, let me make a suggestion. Because the biggest problem with this bill is the contentiousness of defining what taxpayer error is. Let me suggest to the committee respectfully that the bill would be appropriate if the parties agree that there was taxpayer error. Now, the Department of Revenue has an administrative rule with regard to when the department exercises supervisory authority. And this is the authority of the department to go back and correct the rule. It doesn't really have a lot to do with this bill, but except for this fact. The department's rule typically is invoked when the parties, the assessor and the taxpayer, agree to facts indicate there's an error on the rule. A similar sort of amendment to the bill that the taxpayer and the assessor agree that the reduction leading to the refund and interest on the refund was as a result of taxpayer error, just like the Department of Revenue Supervisory Authority holds for their exercise in supervisory authority. That takes the contentiousness out of it. As Mr. Phillips also testified, most cases the taxpayer and the county can sit down and work these out. Having been in court, having gotten a refund and then have to turn around and fight with the taxpayer, it would seem to me that the best way would be to simply provide in the bill that when they agree that it was a result of an error, that there would be no interest on the refund. Thank you very much, and I'm prepared to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Kinnear. Thank you for coming to the Capitol today. Senator George.
When you, first page of the bill, lines 28 through 30, well, actually the following page too, it seems to describe to me a set of circumstances in which the calculation was a result of inaccurate information. I'm sorry about this voice.
It's okay.
The calculation was a result of the inaccurate information. So it would be pretty clear that if that was the case, that the taxpayer would not be entitled to receive interest if, in fact, the calculation was based on inaccurate information. In other words, the garbage in at the front end. So I think the bill is pretty clear relative to the money that would be considered to be available for interest to be paid. In other words, I would have to make a mistake that resulted in a miscalculation in order to get interest under the current situation. But if, in fact, I, under this bill, I made the mistake, I couldn't get interest on my faulty information. That seems to narrow it to me down pretty close as far as fairness.
Well, let me go back to that first example I gave you. The Department of Revenue contended that was a mistake, that fact that they had reported the construction work in progress in 1 year correctly,
right,
and then the second year reported it as addition correctly. Now, the schedule provides that you mention are the costs reported in prior years, but there was no mistake.
Mm-hmm.
The department considered that a mistake. That is in a written report. The second example, again, down at the bottom of these returns, it says environmental contamination. You put down $1 million for cleanup costs. The next year it changes. It turns out it's going to be $10 million. Now, is that a mistake? They made the calculation based on $1 million, and you find out later it's $10 million. Is that a mistake? That's the concern that we have. It's left entirely within the discretion of the county assessor and the Department of Revenue to make that determination, and then it's up to the taxpayer to turn around and sue again if they disagree with it.
So, just on Senator George's point, where's the vagueness, though? You had mentioned that it was vague in terms of where of what the taxpayer errors are, and to me, it seems pretty clear that it would be if the taxpayer, and I guess that gets at your proposed amendment, Mr. Canary, is I don't know what the motivation of, if I'm the taxpayer and I've filed inaccurate data, what motivation is it for me to agree then with the county? Because when I do that, I know my interest is foregone at that point.
Well, for the same reason that the department puts it in their administrative rule for exercise of supervisory power, if the parties agree, then obviously there's no contention. To answer your question, Chair Deckard, is if it's an obvious error, one would think that there would be, the taxpayer would agree, yes, that was my error. But to answer your first question, which is, where is the vagueness? It says, in any portion of the refund that results from an assessment based on inaccurate information contained in a report. Again, if I report $1 million in cleanup costs, which was my best estimate at the time, and it turns out to be $10 million, and we go into court and we say we need a $10 million reduction because of the cost of cleanup, which is provided for by Oregon law, is that inaccurate information? If I report the construction work in progress in 1 year and then report it as an addition as you're required to do in the next year, is that inaccurate information? That's the contentiousness. So what's inaccurate information? It's completely subjective on the part of the Department of Revenue and the assessor. And what is the, I turned the question around to you, what's the motivation of the Department of Revenue and the county assessor to say inaccurate information? They also ask about other things like, if I can find it here. What is your production? Your production report, the actual production, full production, design capacity. What are your work schedules? What are your shifts?
Are you in the department? You're in the department's roles.
Real property, industrial property returns, IPRs.
The guide they would send to someone filling out.
So if you give them that your actual production or design capacity or there's been changes made and it turns out that wasn't entirely accurate, that last year you ran 10 shifts as opposed to 12 shifts, the question is not only inaccurate information, but does it go into the calculation? Did they give you economic obsolescence to reduce the value of your plant based on that? Well, that's pretty subjective, whether you had 10 shifts or 12 shifts. So, again, it's completely within the discretion of the department and the assessor to make that determination. Trust us. We'll do the right thing. But then the only recourse to the taxpayer is to go back to court. And for smaller taxpayers, it's just not economical for them.
Other questions for Mr. Canary or Mr. Marshall, although he quickly got himself off the hook of any questions by saying he's not keeping up with Post 47. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate testimony.
I'd be happy to leave one of your returns with you to show you how complicated it is, if you'd like.
That'd be great for us to be able to look through, pry into someone's return.
Brother Blank.
I know.
I think that's supposed to come off the tanks.
Well, Mary, why don't you say this on the record?
Yes, I had a question. We had previously discussed some of this, and I thought John Phillips might be able to address it too. But on the tax form, someone had mentioned during previous meetings that the construction in progress item was supposed to be removed per the instructions on the tax form, and then in the following year there would be zero reported for construction in progress, and there'd be a dollar amount for addition. So was there anything? I mean, I think we discussed this, and it might have been concluded that the instruction to the taxpayer could be clarified to ensure that they know they have to remove certain items from one year so that there's no double counting in the following year.
Well, if I may, Chair, if you look at these, there are four pages of 8-font print, single-spaced, and again, I'd only point out, as Mr. Phillips said, it's impossible to get all these correct. Yes, you can bury it in there that you should do this and you shouldn't do that. But when you look at the form itself, it talks about complete additions, retirements, and under construction on January 1. It does have this little box that says costs reported in prior years. But that's just one example of where the taxpayer can do the best possible job that he or she can do, report everything correctly, and still have it, quote, be inaccurate information. Not the information's not inaccurate. It's the fact that they didn't do something, which was take it off from the previous year, which is really within the purview of the Department of Revenue.
But my understanding, it is trained. I mean, these aren't individual taxpayers filling out, I wouldn't think, this form. It's trained professionals, CPAs.
No.
Not?
No. I represent a range of commercial but mostly industrial taxpayers. It's generally the lowest person in the tax staff that has to fill these out. These are typically not filled out by CPAs. It's usually one of the assistant controllers in the tax staff of the company. Now, there are companies that do renditions, professional renditions, but it's in my experience for industrial taxpayers, it's the lowest person on the totem pole and gets stuck with the job within
in that office. In your experience, in that office of comptroller,
right,
or fiscal.
Yeah, I refuse to do it. I've had taxpayers ask me, "Can you help us fill?" I said, "No, go talk to the Department of Revenue or go, you know, get one of these professional rendition firms." And these are typically for smaller taxpayers. They're just very complicated and trying to keep up. What typically happens is that a taxpayer will put all of their assets on a disk and simply give the disk to the Department of Revenue. Now, as Mr. Phillips testified, sometimes they haven't deleted things for years and years and years, and that's a problem. And that is a typical problem. In those situations, I think it'd be very easy for the taxpayer and the assessor to come to an agreement. Yeah, you didn't delete it. That's, you know, we don't know what's out there. So I understand what the problem is. Mm-hmm. I'm just suggesting this bill doesn't. Is going to create more problems and more litigation for me than it is for anyone else.
I guess the hard thing might be almost somewhat philosophical, is the interest part of paying interest on an inaccuracy. Because I feel like it's our responsibility as taxpayers in the system that we have to, as much as possible, we have a self-reporting system to identify and report, and then you have a refund process and a true-up process. And to me, I guess it's the interest, because that's a penalty, and why I would receive back penalty payment when it was actually my error that instigated it.
Well, the way I'd respond to that, Senator Deckard, is that the counties have the use of the money. Now, whether it should be 12% or 16%, we've been through that discussion before, and it was the county who decided that was not a good choice. So if it was 4 or 5%, you probably wouldn't have that kind of a philosophical concern. But again, it's not, the concern is not the black and white, it's the gray in between. When is it inaccurate information, and how much contentiousness are we introducing into the system to require a taxpayer to prove otherwise.
Mm-hmm. You almost escaped once, making sure no other questions. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Appreciate it. Well, Gail's up, and yeah. Before I even had a chance
Since
to say.
She was mentioned, I thought it was perfect.
Anyone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. We did not oppose the Walker bill as introduced previous session. That was, there was a, as I recall, a public hearing. There was no action on the bill. And there was no formal opposition to that bill. The bill would have reduced the amount of interest for refunds. So we certainly informally expressed a concern that there, if there was a linkage between refunds for interest and refunds, if there are refunds for the taxpayer, refunds otherwise, then the 12 and 16, if they were linked, then we couldn't disturb one or the other. We mentioned that informally. I don't believe it was on the record, but we did not oppose that bill.
Great. I do remember.
May I add, Mr. Chair, that I was going to make points that you've in fact made, and I just to emphasize very quickly, we're talking about refunds. We're not talking about returning money. We're talking about refunds for errors that are made by the taxpayer under a self-reporting system, This it seems to be of a different order. I don't see the ambiguity in the bill that the opponents do. But the main thing was to correct the record on ALC's position.
Questions for the counties. Gil, do you know, since you're the last, did the House have the same debate that we're having today? Did not.
We had some discussions, I believe, informally, and the House passed the bill out. I don't know that these arguments were aired before that committee.
Okay. And Mr. Canary, you can nod on this one. Did not testify in the House. Okay. It's helpful to know. Anyone else on 2229? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2229, and I'll give members of the committee time to digest and think about whether they want to work this bill or not work it. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2230. Mary.
Okay. House Bill 2230 amends ORS 307.475, which I'll describe briefly in a second, to allow property owners, to apply to the Department of Revenue no later than December 15th for tax relief in the event that an application for redetermination or damaged or destroyed property was not timely filed. The amendment ORS 475 applies to applications for hardship relief that are due on or before July 1st. The current law, lets the property owner apply as late as August 1st of the current assessment year. This bill will give them a three-month extension.
This is John Phillips, friend of John Phillips.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Greg Thummel. I am the conference officer for the Property Tax Division at the Department of Revenue, and as part of my job, I hear conferences, in addition to other things, from people who have submitted petitions under the hardship statute, which is the statute that we are amending or proposing to amend. And normally under this statute, the situation will be a person or entity has failed to file an application for an exemption or a special assessment in a timely fashion and would otherwise have qualified for that exemption or special assessment. They may petition the department for a finding that they had good and sufficient cause for that failure to file on time, and if we find that good and sufficient cause, that then gives the county the authority to go ahead and accept that claim or application, even though it wasn't timely. The situation that I have come across a couple of times each year, I'll receive a petition from people who have lost their homes to a fire in the before the 1st of July. And since property is assessed as of January 1, even though the tax year starts on July 1, they end up being assessed on property that doesn't exist during the tax year. There is a remedy in statute already for that, in that they can apply to the assessor to have their homes valued or their property valued as of July 1 rather than as of January 1. However, they have to get that application into the assessor by August 1. Now, imagine a situation where your house burned down and perhaps you were even injured in that fire and you're in the hospital until October. You fail to get the application in on time, and then you end up paying tax on your home as it existed on January 1. Or even if you weren't injured in the fire, if the fire was late in the year in June, generally that creates a lot of stress and hardship on a person, and they may not make the deadline. This is a fairly simple amendment that would allow us to, under the hardship statute, not only hear petitions for late applications for exemption or special assessment, but also for late applications for the redetermination of value to July 1, so that we could find that there was good and sufficient cause for them to miss that filing deadline, and the assessor could go ahead and accept their application.
All right, questions for Mr. Thummel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2230. Open a work session on House Bill 2230.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2230 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2230 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Senator Burdick wants that one. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2234.
Okay. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2234 eliminates duplicate appeals process. It inserts in ORS 305.560 a section that will change the current appeals process for persons aggrieved in the assessment of omitted property. 305.560 requires that except for an order denying a discretionary waiver of penalty and interest by the Department of Revenue, a person's appeal is initiated by filing a claim with the clerk of the Oregon Tax Court at its principal office in Salem. It inserts in 305.280 something that describes the time of the filing of the appeals by referencing another statute which states that an aggrieved person may appeal to the magistrate division of the Oregon court within 90 days, but no later than 1 year from the date when the act of omission occurs or from the date that an order of determination is made. Or as 305.280 stipulates that the tax court will issue a written decision rejecting a petition from an aggrieved party and reasons will be included that explains the basis for the denial. Under current law, a person aggrieved of an assessment by an assessment of omitted property, that is, property that the tax assessor determines should be added to the tax roll, may appeal to the tax court by initially giving notice to either the tax assessor or the Department of Revenue. The time limits for filing the appeals and the process by which persons are informed of denials are not defined by statute. This basically simplifies the process. It goes to the tax court. Person appeals to the tax court in Salem and is given a notice as opposed to going in either direction.
Makes sense. John, is this your? Yeah. John Phillips. Anyone else who would like to testify?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I'll just make three quick points. The bill eliminates a duplicate notice requirement. It'll save the taxpayer the time and the expense of filing the notice, and it is included in the governor's streamline package. It's almost so simple. It's a redundant process. It's something the taxpayer is required to do but really doesn't need to do, and I think it'll be good for taxpayers.
Great. Questions for Mr. Phillips? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2234. Open the work session on House Bill 2234.
Mr. Chairman, are you pleased to move House Bill 2234 to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Senator George has moved House Bill 2234 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion. So ordered. Let's see here. How about Senator Atkinson will carry that bill? And can we have Senator Atkinson actually carry House Bill 2230 also? We might give him the regulatory streamlining revenue package. We tried the Senate president last. That didn't work out, but I think this one will.
I'm very bummed out at losing House Bill 2230, for the record, Mr. Chair.
We could do co-carriers.
No, I think we'll pass on that.
I'm
it's
open.
All or nothing.
That's true. We have a public hearing on House Bill 2236.
This bill, Mr. Chair, will allow counties to pay contested property tax refunds prior to the conclusion of a property tax appeal, and it provides for collection of additional taxes or payment or additional refund upon resolution of property tax appeals. Appeal applies to refunds related to property taxes prior to 2007 and to appeals pending as of the effective date of this Act. In cases that are under appeal that may take several months to resolve, this bill is an attempt to pay the refund on areas that become clear are no longer disputed before having to wait, let's say, 4 or 5 years to pay interest on all that might be due.
Okay. John Phillips, Doug Hillpott, and David Lawson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips again with the Department of Revenue. This bill is in the category of cutting county losses of revenue to situations that are right now beyond their control. We worked with county assessors on both this bill and 2229 because they deal with the accrual of interest and the payments out of district funds for this interest. Right now, there's a certain small window of time where this negotiation process works out, where you're trying to say, well, what is the value? The taxpayer disputes the value. The assessor tries to work with them and determine what the actual value of the property is, what the property is itself. And sometimes these things then go to court. And Mr. Canary is brought into the situation, for example. What happens is they go through a layer after layer of appeal. For a first layer is the Board of Property Tax Appeals, typically. That's a local board. You're probably familiar with that. Then it might go to the Magistrate Division. That there's an order issued. There's a question that goes on to the tax court. And if at any one of the stages of the value is determined to be lower than what was asserted by the assessor and on the tax roll, this bill would allow the assessor's office, tax collector, at the instruction of the county governing body, to issue a refund. And that would not be, it provides in the bill that would not be sort of an admission that is the correct value, but that it would get the money back into the hands of the taxpayer, it would stop the flow of interest, and then any future order that changed the value up or down could then be dealt with as either a tax billing or an additional tax refund. That's the fundamental idea here. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Phillips before we hear from, go right down the line,
Mr. Chair, good morning, members of the committee. My name is David Lawson. I'm Yamhill County Assessor, Tax Collector. I have real experience with this issue. My good friend, Mr. Canary, and I have negotiated some extreme reductions in industrial values that triggered hundreds of thousands of dollars of interest. This year, we went outside the box with one of our large appeals. The Department of Revenue, Mr. Canary, and the client allowed us to come to an unagreed-upon value. We reduced to that value, sent a refund to the taxpayer, continued to negotiate, came to a settlement much lower than where I had reduced the value, again refunded with interest to our taxpayers. I believe this is good government, good business. I can't imagine why any business would be opposed to this. It gets their money back. And it's not just the county losing money. This comes from the unsegregated tax fund, so all districts are impacted. My concern as an assessor was, let's say I lowered to $150 million and it's adjudicated at $160. What happens to that $10 million? Does the taxpayer have to pay interest while we've been? And I think it's clear that they do not have to pay interest on the adjudicated value if it's more than we agreed upon. So that in itself makes it, in my mind, fair-minded for all parties, a win-win. I don't think it would be good business if the taxpayer had to pay interest on that $10 million more than we adjudicated to because we were in negotiations. So I support this bill strongly. I think it's good for the state of Oregon, for counties and all taxing districts, and I believe it's good for business and industry. My friend David might not think that, but thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Lawson?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I want to make sure I understand this one. If you're in a tax dispute and it may take years to resolve in the courts, and so you, under this bill, you can go ahead and pay what you think is a reasonable refund, what you think is a reasonable refund, kind of your idea of what's fair. The taxpayer doesn't have to agree to that.
Under that, that's correct. Under
as a result, he gets a big chunk of money sooner, and you save paying 12% interest on the whole thing when it is finally resolved.
That is accurate.
Sounds like a win-win to me.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Mr. Hillpot.
For the record, I'm Doug Hillpot, Benton County Assessor. I'm here for the County Assessors Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my testimony goes along with my other two friends here that it just seems like a fairness issue. Certainly, we're a small county. We don't get into huge appeal matters like some of the other counties do. But in the instances, it's so frustrating when you are able to look at a value, you can tell that, you know, and just as an example, we have something at $2 million on the roll. There's an appeal, and they say it's worth $1 million. We do our research, look at it specifically, and say, you know, $1.5 million is probably the right number. But we are precluded at this point from going ahead and setting it at $1.5 million, issuing the refund. Certainly, it doesn't stop the appeal rights, and if they want to go for the million, that's fine. Go through the procedures, but then it's just that difference that the extra interest is being paid on after that effect. So, not to beat a horse to death or whatever that is,
beat
but
beat a dead horse.
Yeah, there you go. Beat a dead horse. Thank you.
Beat a horse. Sure. We've outlawed beating horses.
That's true. That's true.
I've heard that in states you can actually get more time for beating your horse than you can for family members or something. But that's another issue. Anyway.
Our verdict, do you want to get in on this?
No. Not to touch on sore points, I'm sorry.
Questions for this panel?
Let's do it.
John?
Mr. Chair, if there's any interest, I could certainly walk the committee through how it does what we talked about. I'd be happy to do that, too.
You mean just a quick example of
how the bill itself actually accomplishes the objective? Well, if you want, if you're inclined, I don't want to slow you down.
I think but let's hear from, we do have Mr. Canary and Mr. Marshall signed up.
That's one of the reasons why.
Oh, okay.
My mind.
Okay. Walk us through the bill. Just to make sure. Okay, that's a good
Dave's
place
got that to. Eagle eye, you know. And Mr. Chair, this section of law deals with when the county refunds. That's the purpose of 311-806. On page 2 in subsection 4, which is new, it directs the tax collector to issue a refund if, and then in here are the conditions. Tax collector just can't act unilaterally. The county board of property tax appeals or the tax court, as we discussed, there's an appeal, and it results in a refund, the decision that's upheld on appeal. So this is always going to be in a situation where there's an appeal, and there's always going to be in a situation after an order has been issued. There may be a further appeal, but that's notwithstanding. C, the county governing body orders the refund. So, again, the tax collector is not acting unilaterally. The board recommends the taxpayer in this regard may not be considered in matters determining. So what it's saying here is that this does not concede that the order is the correct value. There may be an appeal by the tax collector or the assessor or by the taxpayer. So it may continue. But this, again, is designed just to stop the flow of interest. And then later on it says at the top of the next page, if after taking into account the refund, then the final resolution results in additional taxes. So in some cases, as in what Dave suggested as an example, if the court actually finds for a higher value than what was refunded on or a previous court had ruled,
then there would be a billing. So that means that the taxpayers then bill additional if the court finds that the value is actually higher than what the earlier court determined.
Without interest.
And that's the key thing, is that in any case where there's additional taxes as a result of an appeal, even if it's a five-year-old appeal, the taxpayer is not responsible for interest back to the date of the and the year in which the taxes would have been due had they been paid on time. So, and that's the whole purpose of these two bills, is to get sort of the playing field level. So, thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Canary, Mr. Marshall. We can't ask John questions about compression under Measure 47.
Please don't.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, I'm Dave Canary. Actually, I'm sitting in for Chris Robinson, another member of AOI. Unfortunately, Mr. Robinson had to argue a case at 9 o'clock in front of the Oregon Tax Court, so I have not prepared any written testimony. There were two concerns that Mr. Robinson expressed to me and that I also had with regard to this bill. One is the situation that Dave Lawson and I had or discussed, where the county reduces the value, say, from, well, in our case, it was about $230 million down to $150 million. We resolved the case at a much lower value, so the concern that I have didn't come up. But what would happen is if, in a situation that the final adjudication was higher than the value that the county had reduced it to, what would happen? My first concern in reading the bill was whether or not there was interest at 16% that the taxpayer would have to pay. And I understand from Mr. Phillips and Mr. Lawson that would not be the case. And I'm not as familiar with the bill as I was for 2229, so I'll take their word for it. So that alleviates one of my concerns, and I was happy to hear that. The second concern is these cases can go on for a number of years. In the NORPAC case that was widely publicized here in Marion County, went on for 9 years, and there was $3.5 million tax refund, of which about $1 million of that was interest. The problem is that if the refund is made, say, in the first year, down to the 150, and it comes in later at 160 or maybe 200, and there's a change of ownership of the property. Now, it doesn't happen a lot with industrial property. It certainly happens a lot with commercial property. Who pays that additional taxes if the appeal started 3 years ago? And that's the case of Mr. Robinson, because he has a number of commercial property. I think Mr. Lawson is familiar with the fact that the low-income housing went on for 9 years, I think. So that is a concern. I don't know how you change that in the bill other than not allowing the county to advocate for more value than what they reduced it to. So and one other point. In our case, the taxpayer, when we finished our case with Mr. Lawson in Yamhill County, the taxpayer waived the entire amount of interest. So, Senator Deckard, in response to one of your questions on 2229, taxpayers do act honorably and sometimes against their own economic interests when it's clear that there was an error.
I wasn't insinuating that taxpayers don't act honorably. It's just the system set up to protect as much, and I think every taxpayer does that or tries to file the returns accurately, but also protect as much of their assets as they possibly can. Questions for Mr. Canary?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
It strikes me that if a person sold a piece of commercial property on which there was a pending case that had not been resolved, that would come out in the title insurance company would earnest. Find that out. That would have to be resolved as a part of the conditions of the sale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Typically, there's only a pro. If I may, I'm sorry. There's a proration of taxes for the year based on the date of sale. I don't know how they would handle. I'm not a commercial business lawyer.
Well, you have to have a clean title to transfer, and the title obviously wouldn't be clean if there was a case pending against it.
Other questions for Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2236 and open the work session on House Bill 2236.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House Bill 2236 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2236 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections to that motion? So ordered. And Senator Monroe, you gave such a good, whenever you give a two-sentence explanation of a bill, it's a good case for carrying it. We are adjourned until tomorrow at 8:45.